Lord, thank you for Shabbat, and thank you for this time of year, and the holidays, and the things it leads us to think. And I pray that you would work through that in our lives, and show us how it pertains to us, and how it affects our actions. Help us make right judgments every day, every moment. And we ask for your spirit to be with us as we read and discuss your word this morning. In Jesus' name.
Amen.
All right. So as you may perceive from my prayer, I've still been thinking along the lines of our year. Welcome. We've just finished celebrating Purim. And we're anticipating Pesach, Passover. And so I've been thinking about those two things. Before last week's Bible study, we were talking about the sower and what that leads us to see.
Hey, sorry, I thought it was your father.
That's okay. There was a switch at the end.
Can I sit here?
You may sit there. And if you come back next week, you'll get him again. So, the 2 weeks before last week, we were talking about the book of Esther and different connections to other Bible stories and how that influences our understanding. And so, I actually wanted to go back to Esther briefly, and then if we have more time, we can look forward. Because some people see connections to the story of Joseph in Esther.
Great.
Many people see connections to the story of Joseph. And the question is, what are those connections doing? And what is the connection between Passover and Purim? If there is one. So we're going to be looking at that. And for those of you who are sick of Esther, I'm sorry, but...
Never.
Never. You can't get enough of us.
No, it's a good story.
That's right. Kind of like a diamond where, you know, you can always see a new facet. And I really think that's the case with all our Bible stories. They're very much more complicated than... You can't just read it like a newspaper. There are many more levels and many more facets that shoot you to other places, and it will affect how you read it. So even though we keep reading the same old stories, we see new things. So, tell me what you see might be a connection between Esther and Joseph. What's one thing that comes to your mind?
It's complicated, isn't it?
They both help save their nation.
They both help save their nation? Okay, that's the big picture. Where is Joseph?
In Egypt.
In Egypt.
So they're both in foreign countries.
They're both in foreign countries, right? Esther, we know, is Jewish, but she's living in Persia. Joseph is, we'll use the term Jewish anachronistically because it helps with the comparison. In Joseph's day, he would be an Ivri, a Hebrew. A Hebrew living in the land of Egypt. So they're living in foreign lands. What else? Okay, wait, we mentioned... Jews, Hebrews. In a foreign land.
It's something about being wrongly accused and being in prison and... But I can't get my head around it, what the connection is.
Okay, well, let's start with the big thing. Wait, let me write down what you said. They're both working to save their people.
Both kind of behind the scenes a little bit.
That's good.
A little bit not up front at the first, and then.
Okay, both working behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's good.
That's maybe a lot history, a lot.
And they both come before the leader of that nation.
They both what?
They both come before the leader.
Before the king.
Uh-huh.
Before the king.
Come before the king.
And they both have this huge respect for the king. He's not just a sort of terrible boss. There's this huge sort of honouring respect to do what is right for the king.
And yet there's also some danger, as
right.
If it's any king, right?
Right.
We could put in sub-themes here of honour and danger.
They both have an enemy.
They both have an enemy? Okay, who's Joseph's enemy?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
Potiphar's wife?
Yeah,
okay.
She wants to set him up, doesn't she? In the same way as Haman wants to set up Esther.
Non-Jews.
Of course, you could say everyone has an enemy.
They both have a friend as well, Mordecai, and the person that Joseph met in prison who finally remembered to mention him.
Either the baker or the other one.
They
I never remember which is
to,
which.
To shift their position.
Right, they both need help from others. You could say in the danger, they both are in danger of losing their life. Joseph in prison could have equally been taken out and hung, but instead he was taken out and honored in the same way that Esther could have been banished or hung or something.
Both of them come from nowhere in comparison to the power.
Right, they're foreigners. And they have no family connection to leadership.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. In Joseph's case, he's actually sold by his brothers. So
he has no connection to the power in Egypt. And she has no connection as a Jew to.
And she's an orphan who's rounded up by the king.
Of a refugee nation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were put in a place of power and influence.
Both put in a place of power and influence. Yeah,
yeah, that's
did I
good.
Not have that?
In the foreign land, somehow they were enslaved. They were under the foreign land.
Now, a lot of the situations change. If you think of Joseph's story, it's drastically different from the beginning to the end, as is the same with Esther's story. I'd like to go back and fill in some of these things with some details. All right. Where should we begin? They both, you could say, we didn't put this up here, you were trying to get at it over there. They both had no connection to the leadership, the government, and they were also both there not by choice. Right? You could add this, not by choice. They're in the foreign land.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Except God's choice.
Not by choice. Not by their choice. Okay. And if, well, one more thing while we're putting up the big picture, they're both successful. They're both very successful.
Do you have any idea the ages they would have been?
Well, Esther would have been young, and Joseph, I think, would have been young. So they're both similar ages at the beginning of the story. Joseph spans kind of a lifetime, where Esther seems to happen more quickly, within a year or two.
Do we have any idea how long Joseph was in Egypt for before the story begins? I mean, we do know it's 2 years in prison, but we don't know quite.
No, we don't.
We don't have any idea.
But there are years involved. He definitely grows up there.
Yeah, he's a young guy when he goes down.
And when you think about identity and Jewish identity, again, we mentioned it, they both kind of work behind the scenes. Their true identity as Jews is hidden at first.
Yeah.
If you remember, the brothers come to see Joseph, he looks Egyptian, right? They have no hint externally that he's a Hebrew.
It's 10 hours.
Okay. So let's point to some little verbal links, and we might, I don't know how to lay it out in chronologically, so we're kind of going to jump back and forth chronologically, and I apologize, but let's look at Esther 8, verse 2.
Oh, amazing. I've never seen that.
Esther 8.
The king took off his signet ring, which he'd reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai.
That's right.
And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. And Pharaoh takes off his ring and gives it to Joseph.
Correct. Now, one thing, when we're doing this comparison, I'm talking about the whole story of Esther, because the main character in the scroll of Esther is split between Esther and Mordecai. The first half, Mordecai is the one initiating everything. And then at chapter 4, when Esther has her epiphany, she becomes the one that initiates. And so even though they're both always involved in the story, in terms of the main character and supporting role, like we were going to give an Oscar, we truly have to split it between Esther and Mordecai. Because it's Mordecai is the main one with Esther a supporting role, and then it becomes Esther the main one with Mordecai a supporting role. So in terms of the parallel to Joseph, we can see parallels to both Esther and Mordecai in the scroll. And it kind of will follow along the lines of who is the dominant character at that moment. So yes, so at this point in the story, in chapter 8 of Esther, Esther is the main character. And so you notice that even though he gives the ring to Mordecai, he puts Esther... Esther puts Mordecai in charge of Haman's house. So Esther is the one in charge and the one acting at this point. But yeah, so that's the main key. I'll write up Esther 8:2. The king takes off his signet ring. So then look at the words. We'll go back to our Genesis story. Sorry. Got too many screens open here. Genesis 41:42. And what does it say there? Genesis 41:42.
Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck.
Okay. So notice the same verb. Vayatzav et tabato. He took off his ring. Me'al yado vayitenota al yad Yosef. And he puts it on Joseph. So the verbal link is very clear. Vayalbeshoto. And so he clothes him. In this case, for Joseph, it's Bigdei Shesh and a nice necklace. In Mordechai's case, it's not in the same verse. We have to look a little further down. But we were in Esther 8:2. If you just look at Esther 8, let me tell you the verse, 15. Mordechai leaves the king's presence with clothing of the kingdom. Tchelet v'chul v'ateret zahav gdola. So he's got a big gold crown and tachrich boots.
question is this: why is those colors of blue and white?
Possibly. I mean, it's also connected to the priesthood, right? The strand of blue within the white. And actually, a lot of these things, Tchelet, Chur, Zahav, and Kesef, Booth and Argaman, you could say there are some similarities to the temple glory. And if you are looking within the book of Esther only, the whole book starts out with this view of Ahasuerus's glorious kingdom. And it uses all these elements to describe it. So in a sense, in this grand reversal, you have Mordechai taking on the glory of the kingdom of Persia. So instead of the king having all this glory, it's now passed on to Mordechai in his clothes. But in terms of our connection here, they both get new clothes from the king. New fancy clothes, I'll say. So they both get a signet ring and clothes that show their position, how respected they are within that kingdom.
Can I say something? Something just really dawned on me. We were thinking a lot, a friend of mine was thinking a lot about the royalty and the kingdom message of Esther, the book of Esther. If you go through, you know, we're all busy screaming about Haman, but if you actually go through, it's about the king, it's about royalty, it's about the kingdom. And if you put that into the language of us, the believers, what happens when you get, when you become part of the kingdom of God is within us, we get the clothing, the royalty, almost the authority, because what is the ring? It's
authority.
It's the authority. It's the authority that we have as believers. I mean, it's really powerful. I had never seen that before.
Yeah, and that connection would be highly ironic, because I think the author of Esther, he's presenting the grandeur of the kingdom of Persia, but under the surface he's saying, he's actually poking fun at the king and all this grandeur and their law system. So he's showing both sides, the immensity of the kingdom and the glory of it, and yet the ridiculousness of it.
But also that it's the same thing with for us about the glory of the things of this world. We're all wanting the glory and the power and the authority of this world. And the Lord is saying, no, I'm going to clothe you with my garments of righteousness.
You could say, yeah. So there's the same dichotomy between what is seen and what is not seen.
Wow.
And for many of us, it can be very ironic that the reality is that we are children of the kingdom, and yet what people see may or may not fit into that.
And then thinking all the character things that we could say, humility and obedience and everything they did,
right?
The character also, strong character, good character.
Look also at Genesis 45:5. Oh wait, before we go there, because that's actually more of a contrast, let's look at Esther 2 and Genesis 41. So we're going to look at Esther 2, verses 3 and 4. Esther 2, 3 to 4 gives us some advice to the king. His advisors say, Ve'yafked ha-melech, let the king appoint appointees. Ve'yafked ha-melech p'kidim b'chol medinot malchuto. So that particular phrase, let the king appoint appointees, clerks,
commissioners
in all his states or all sections of the kingdom, and let every young virgin who's beautiful be gathered together. Okay, that's advice. And then in the next verse, in verse 4, are you all with me in Esther chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. After the king gets his advice, it says, and the thing was good in the eyes of the king. So he did so.
Just say, and it says under the custody of Haggai, and also again in verse 8, and it makes me think there's another parallel between Joseph and Esther. if she's under custody, she's actually going through the same type of containment
that
Joseph went through.
That's similar too. Yeah, they're both, maybe that fits into this theme, not by choice. They're both put under people, and they both, Joseph and Esther, please the people they're put under. They're very obedient, and they rise to the top of even the low ranks.
Yes.
So we have Hegai here, who's in charge of the harem, or the all the girls, and Joseph, I forget who is, does he have a name? We'll have to look at that.
The jailer.
The jailer.
The steward of the jail, or some such title, isn't it?
Yes. Right, yeah, that's a great great parallel. So back to the king gets advice.
What's the Genesis?
And he likes it. Genesis 41, verses 34 to 37. And again, we're looking at the wording specifically.
Says exactly the same, appoint commissioner.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Veyafked kidim, the exact same word.
Paked. It's
to appoint, appointees.
The modern word paked is
officer.
It's like an officer. It's the guy in charge. It's the
paked is someone in charge of something
doing
else.
Doing something else. Yeah.
You know, you can have higher ranks or lower ranks.
We have them all the time, yeah.
Exactly. So it says, let Pharaoh do, Yase Pharao ve'yafked kidim al ha'aretz. Let him appoint these commissioners or appointees on the land. And then, of course, it's different because we have a different scenario. Because we're dealing with, this advice is coming about how to deal with the years of famine that are coming. But then, if you look in verse 35, ve'yikbetzu et kol ochel hashanim hatovot. So let all the food from the good years be gathered together. So we still have that same verb, let them be gathered together, that we had with let all the pretty girls be gathered together. So there's a lot of verbal links all within those two verses. And then look at what the king says in verse 37. And the thing was good in the eyes of Pharaoh. So the exact same response from Pharaoh. So we have a lot of parallels in the exact wording used between Esther and the story of Joseph. So in this case, it's kind of nice because we know Esther wasn't written before the time that the story is set in, right? And so we know in many cases in the Bible, you see two things. Let's say a prophecy in Micah and Isaiah, and you're not quite sure who was first, or who's borrowing who, or how they interrelate. Well, here we know because Esther is later than the Torah, and so when the author of Esther is writing his story, when there are all these links back to these other stories, they're on purpose. He has the other stories in his mind, and he's presuming you do too. And so when he's borrowing words like this, it's to send you back to those original stories and make you think about it. Now, of course, he's not telling you exactly what you're supposed to think about, but he's leaving that to you as adults and readers of the text. That's the fun part. So here we have the verbal links, in addition to all these thematic links. Now, one of the things that he might be wanting you to think about is what I mentioned earlier. If you look now at Genesis 45:5, this is when Joseph has revealed his identity to his brothers. And he says, and now don't be sad. And don't let it be a bad thing in your eyes that you sold me here. Because for living, God sent me before you.
It was to save lives.
To save lives, yeah. Le Michia. For keeping alive. I like that word. You can get a scholarship at Hebrew University for keeping alive as a student.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky. If you're Joseph. It was for keeping alive. So how is this different than our author in Esther? Tell me the obvious. Do we have a statement like this in Esther?
Yeah.
Where?
Well, to keep alive the whole people. It's almost the same. It's to keep alive the whole people.
Okay, but the critical difference is Shlahani Elohim. Right?
Because
Esther never says God sent me.
We never get told that.
You never get told that explicitly. It's definitely between the lines.
Right.
But it's never said explicitly. And part of the way it gets put between the lines may be the parallels to Joseph. We've looked at these verbal connections, so we're already hinted by the author that we should be going back and reading Joseph and thinking about it. And when we do that, we find out in Joseph, hey, all these weird events and seemingly coincidences and even bad things turned out to be God sent me for this purpose. And so then when we read Esther chapter 4, when it says, maybe for such a time as this, you're in the kingdom, we put in between the lines that it's God's purpose. Because we see it in history. It was God's purpose for Joseph. Maybe it's God's purpose now in the book of Esther. So that could be Esther's author's way of hinting at, hey, this is all part of God's design. And again, they're both very successful stories. But there's also, I've been reading a book by Jonathan Grossman. He wrote a commentary on Esther that's very nice, came out recently. Well, it recently came out in Hebrew. It came out earlier in English. And actually, the English version has more footnotes if you're interested. It's called, can't remember the exact title, but something about hidden meaning.
So did you say who wrote Esther? Any idea?
Who wrote Esther? No. No.
No idea.
No idea.
No.
Many books in the Bible, we have no idea who wrote.
Not Mordecai.
No. Presumably, Esther and Mordecai wrote letters, but
something's taken.
No. But so Jonathan Grossman's interpretation of what's going on here is that there's also a hint dealing with the whole issue of Jews in exile. And it's a fascinating topic when you think about Esther. When was the Second Temple built? You know when Isaiah says, Koresh Meshichi, Cyrus, my deliverer, he's going to deliver the people, right? He's going to allow the Israelites to go back to their land and build a temple. Good news. When did Cyrus allow that?
500 or something.
538, okay. And it started work, they had some opposition. The work continued. When was the temple completed?
516.
516, maybe I've also learned 515 and I don't know the dating system, but under Darius. Who is Ahasuerus? Who does the story seem to line up best with in terms of Persian kings?
Cyrus.
Not Cyrus, Persian kings.
A Persian king.
If you open your English Bibles, what does it say? King?
Xerxes
1. And when does King Xerxes 1 rule? You don't have to give me specific years, but is it before or after this?
After.
After.
Or 57,
yes. 486 to 465
is what?
Is King Xerxes. Xerxes 1. This is completion. Oh, 515 is the dedication of the temple. What temple? So 538 is when Cyrus gives them permission to start the process. 516 is completed. 515 when it's dedicated. And this is under Darius. So this adds an interesting dimension to the whole story of Esther, right?
I've lost it. You have to go on.
I have to go on? Okay, right here, Esther's going on. Esther is set in this time frame. That means when Esther is going on in Shushan, in the capital of Persia, there are already Jews back home, right? There are already Jews that have built the temple living in Jerusalem. Why is Esther still in exile? Why are there still Jews all over that haven't gone back to the land? Right? So this is an interesting thing to think about as you're reading the story. What does it say about living in exile and living in the promised land?
They were mixed with the heathen people.
Well, they weren't, according to Haman, they weren't mixed with the heathen people. You're talking about the northern kingdom. When the Assyrians came in, this is in the 700s, 721, they came in and conquered the northern kingdom, and they purposefully mixed the people there with others. We'll call them heathen, if you want to use that word. But the southern kingdom is the one that fell to Babylon, right? Judah and Benjamin, they're the ones that fell to Babylon. They did not get mixed in. That was not, the Babylonians were not like the Assyrians. They had different policies. They were exiled. And we see through Haman's words, there's a certain people among us that don't integrate. They're not intermarrying. They abide by their own rules. So we know they were actually living as Jews. They were living distinct from the people around them. So, it's just, I'm not giving an answer to this question as much as making us think about what it means. Because both of these, Joseph and Esther, are both Jews and Hebrews living in exile. And we see the hand of God, even in exile, that's working for them, and they rise up to the top of the government. However, there are serious dangers because they're living in exile, right? And so back to this Jonathan Grossman guy, he sees a hint. While it's a story of success and God is there to save you, he sees a hint that that the hidden message is there's danger in exile.
Right.
And it's not the ideal. And part of that hint is he finds in Esther 10:1. Esther 10:1, Vayatem Hamelech Achashverosh Mas al Haaretz ve'iye Hayam. So the king puts a tax on the land and on the islands of the sea. Okay. So the Jews have protectia. They have someone in high places working in their favor. They have Mordecai and Esther. The other people, not so much. Not that we know of. And the king puts a tax on the people. Now,
it's like today.
Today, mas just means tax, right? But I'm not sure all the intricacies of the argument, but there are contexts in the Bible where mas is actually forced labor.
Usually coordinated labor.
So if you view it as forced labor, now the parallel to Joseph jumps out at you. If the very next thing that happens in the book of Esther, yeah, Mordecai's up in his position, but now the king's putting forced labor on people. And what happens when there's a new king who doesn't know Mordecai, right? So let's go back to the Joseph story.
Which is exactly the same.
It's exactly what happened with Joseph's story.
And you, not Joseph.
Look at Exodus 1. Okay.
That's a very powerful phrase in Hebrew. What is it? We got to there.
Okay, first, Exodus 1:8. And there rose up a new king over Egypt.
Read it in Hebrew because it's very strong.
Vayako melech hadash al Mitzrayim asher lo yada et Yosef. Who did not know Joseph. Yeah. So the whole start of Exodus and the whole thing we're working towards now before Pesach, the deliverance from Egypt.
Ah, getting that.
You know, there's a king. Joseph is now out of the picture. The people are already in Egypt because Joseph had connections. So they're already, there's no return at that moment. They've already economically linked in. They've already resettled. And now a new king comes and he doesn't know Joseph. So what happens in verse 11? Vayasimu alav sare misim. So you have the same collocation, lasim, to put on. Here it's ministers of forced labor, sare misim, and not the forced labor itself. But Jonathan Grossman points out that the connection lasim and mas only comes here in Exodus. Other places they use noten mas or other verbs. So there is again a verbal link between Esther 10:1 and this situation in Egypt. So we have this happy ending in Esther, but there is a little underlying between the line thing that says, but think about it. And so I think the idea, and truly it fits with our calendar that you celebrate Purim every year, the idea is history is cyclical. And God is always working behind the scenes to save his people, but note the connections. Look at what happened in Egypt. God worked through it, but then it ended in slavery, and God had to work again. Like, being in exile is not actually a good thing.
Right.
It's better to get out of there. Mm-hmm. And I think that may be embedded in some of these links.
Your earlier point about how there were Jews already back in the Promised Land.
Yeah.
They're building a temple.
Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai.
Right, but Esther and Mordecai are still in exile. Like, those Jews are seen as, what are you doing? You should have gone back. Like, why are you still in exile? Like, is that the point?
Well, if we could travel back in time and talk to Ezra,
yeah.
What do you think he would have said?
Yeah, you guys are, you've had the opportunity. What are you still doing there?
Yeah, I mean.
Because there's that sort of kind of cloud hanging over Jews who don't come back to the Promised Land, sort of even today.
What are you doing still in exile?
Yeah,
it's true.
And there's this cloud over even Esther. I mean, Esther's a hero. On the other hand, she's the ultimate slut. She's marrying a non-Jew. She's doing the she's doing the worst thing possible.
And on a certain level, she raises many eyebrows to understand.
Yeah, she's only a hero because it works. If she had just married a non-Jewish anyone,
she's only a hero when you read between the lines that actually is part of a bigger design.
Yeah.
Right.
If she had just married this guy, nothing happens. She would have been, oh, there goes another Jewish woman marrying a non-Jewish guy. What a slut.
Right.
Not a slut, but she'd be cut off from her people.
Although in Ezra Nehemiah's day, if you remember, it was patrilinear. And so their big issue was go divorce all your foreign wives.
Right.
They don't much mention the Israelite wives. I guess the assumption is they're marrying
But I imagine that in Persian culture they wouldn't have considered the king's kids Jewish.
No.
Despite what the Jewish community would have felt about their kids.
Right.
But so there's this, so like it goes back to the message that you're saying that Esther is saying, that the book of Esther, the
right.
author is saying that, you know, here's a way of preserving your identity when you're in these types of situations. You're a Mordechai, you're an Esther. You're in such a sticky situation, you can't even reveal your identity, you can't even use the word God in your daily life. You're in absolute secular situations, but you know, God is present, and God can still be with you in a situation where the rest of the community thinks you're a slut, you're a traitor.
It gives you both sides of the coin, in some sense. Even if one side of the coin may be presented as more ideal than the other, it certainly shows the bigness of God, that He can be working through both routes. And in terms of identity, I think they both have that turning point where they do show their identity. It's just at the right time. It's not on parade for everybody to know until it's necessary, like for Joseph and for Esther.
And if you bring it into modern history, I mean, you think of the people who've been saying to the Jews, certainly in the last 100 years, get out of the diaspora, get back, get back, get back, get back, get back, and they've been ignored. And the judgment, the judgment has come, or the slavery has come, or whatever. You think of Jabotinsky and all his warnings and so on. It's very powerful stuff.
It's actually interesting, if you're going to talk about modern history, that the whole, basically most of Zionism was secular.
All of it.
That's a nice little irony to it.
Right.
That exile was kind of the assumed thing, and it took seculars to think, well, hey, we need to.
And yet, it was an act of God. Can a nation be born in a day? I mean, it
was. You could see it that way for sure. In the same way that Esther is an act of God, that no one's. Again, I like the book of Esther because. In our world, no one's writing for us, hey, this is God and this isn't. Like, we don't have the perspective of heavenly places. We see and we have to interpret what we see on a human plane. Obviously, you know, God is speaking to us, but there are a lot of Christians who say different things. So if God is speaking to Christians, it can still be confusing, right? Because who's right? Am I right or is that other person right? And that's why the book of Esther can be encouraging, actually. Because in some ways, this is where it gets really hairy, what Danny was saying, in some ways, they're both right. What if I'm right and the person who says the opposite thing to me is right? Somehow that God can work in both situations. He can work in the exile, and He can also work in bringing the people back at the very same time. And He's an expert at making good out of a bad situation. It inspires me to be more humble. Whatever position you want to take, be humble about the people who don't agree with that position. But before we end this...
I like your husband's comment, write your theology in pencil.
Write your theology in pencil. That's good. There are, you know, the basics. The David Pelegi used to talk about flexibility. There's a lot of flexibility in theology, as long as you don't break the basics. Like, God is good. You know, that's inside. And like these, let's say this is a rubber band. Some things can bend, but there's certain things, if you go outside of that, you've left. And so, a lot of your theology, especially when it gets in this area or here, needs to be written in pencil, because you may want to erase it, alter it, change it as you grow and learn more. So the other thing to point out about the story of Esther, what date is set? When is Purim?
14th of Adar.
14th
Adar.
Of Adar. Right? 14th and 15th?
And Pesach is the 14th and 15th of Nisan.
Right. And so you have Adar, and then you have Nisan. Bein Ha'arbaim, right? Pesach is the evening. So you have exactly 1 month between Purim and Pesach. And so the story of redemption in Esther and the story of redemption from Egypt is also paralleled in the calendar of the year. Or they're not, let's say not paralleled, but they're connected. They're linked somehow. And so you're thinking about it. There are those who have done more along that line, but I brought these because they're actual verbal links that work really well. Other things can be very generic, like Esther and Mordecai can parallel Aaron and Moses. If you remember, Moses wants someone else to speak for him, so Aaron gets put in position to speak to the king. And so Esther and Mordecai, you know, Mordecai sends Esther and Esther speaks to the king. You could see those kind of things. But in other ways, maybe Esther parallels Moses. So it's more of a general, more thematic link. But you could say they are there. And I like, I didn't write this up. I like that Esther 10:1, that link back to Exodus 1 and the need for salvation, deliverance, that indeed life tends to be cyclical. And certainly the life of the people of God in history has been cyclical, even up to modern times. However you see those things and interpret them, it's there. There are cycles that keep repeating. And Gary just got a birthday present of Jewish life in America. And I've been reading just the opening paragraphs. I'm sorry, this is a bit of a segue, but it was just fascinating how many anti-Semitic, just blatantly anti-Semitic quotes there were by Stewie Vesant, who's the Dutch guy who started New York City. And just, you just think, wow. You know, really, you can see these cycles.
All of them. I mean, so many.
All through history. And I just think to myself, like, how on earth, out of all the peoples in the world, is there this consistent anti-ness? Mm-hmm. You know, it's really quite amazing. Mm-hmm. And even in that, like I was in these quotes, there are successes and there are appeals to the governments, like, hey, we're fighting the same way as others, give us citizenship like the rest of the people. They had a fight for it in New York City, you know? And why were they allowed? Economics. And it's just, it's always like there are these mini successes, but they're tenuous. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's all very fascinating. So those are my personal ruminations, but B, as you leave, go back and read the story of Joseph, because I think it'll be a nice lead up to our thoughts on Passover and redemption out of Egypt. And I know as Christians, we tend to jump quickly to the spiritual thing, and so it becomes more abstract and simplified. And so it's nice to go back and read the story, because I think I know the more I read the story, every year I see new things, and there's more complexities that may actually even add to your spiritual reading of it. So before you do the abstract, go back to the basics and read through it. And maybe we'll get a chance to do that together, including the Pesach story itself in the coming weeks. So, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.